world, and welcome to this week's episode of Information Week Live. I have to tell you that this week is going to be a great episode, I think. We've got a lot to talk about, and, well, we've got a great panel lined up to talk about it with everyone. I'm joined today by my colleagues, first from Dark Reading, their senior editor, Sarah Peters, is with us. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt.
We also have our regular columnist, Dave Wagner, Information Week's executive editor for Community and IT Life. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt.
I want to remind everyone who's listening live that you're part of the conversation as well. In addition to this audio discussion we've got going, there's a great conversation that has started on Information Week Live, and all you have to do to add your voice to that conversation is type your comment or question into the box helpfully labeled your post, then be sure to click on that big red post button beneath the box. Well, I want to get started, and the biggest story of the week, Sarah, I think comes out of your world. Well, it seems like everybody the last, probably 36 hours has been talking about, well, the fact that everyone who ever worked for the federal government has had their personal information stolen by someone who probably speaks Mandarin. What do you know about this story?
Actually, I don't think it's been that long. The news broke just about, let's say, 23 hours ago. For the records of 4 million federal employees were compromised in a breach affecting the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. So that's basically the HR department for the federal government. So it could potentially impact every federal agency because it's got the employees of every federal agency, and that includes things like background checks. And there's, you know, concern that it could endanger intelligence agents and things like that because it's got information about it's got background information, and then it also may have information about the families and all of that kind of thing that can jeopardize their position. So what they're saying, there hasn't been a lot of information so far about the on the technical side as to what exactly happened, but they are saying already that they think that there were Chinese hackers behind it. They are not saying that it was the PLA. They're not saying it was the official arm of the Chinese government that does this sort of thing. But they are saying that it is probably there's a security firm saying that there are technical indicators that seem to tie this attack to the same people who are behind the attacks on Anthem and Primera, those two big breaches at healthcare insurers. So the Anthem breach was of 80 million insured people, and at Primera was 11 million. So it's big, it's bad, and there's definitely more that we will hear about it, and probably none of it will be good.
Oh, Dave, I've got to ask you. Now, you tend to be our privacy hawk here on Information Week Live. So when you hear a story like this, does it just confirm what you felt instinctively was coming anyway, or do you find that this kind of thing still surprises you?
Well, you know what surprised me about what Sarah just said is that basically she said that in those three hacks, this one group basically exposed the private information of one-third of the United States. Like, there's some overlap there, but realistically, we're talking about, you know, 25 to 30% of America in just that one group alone. I question whether there's such a thing anymore as anybody's private data that hasn't been hacked at least once. So I don't know if I'd say I expected this. One of the things I'd like to think is that our federal government is a little bit better at this. But I think we're getting to the point where anybody, federal government, Chinese government, Russian government, there's just no such thing anymore as somebody who has a security advantage over anybody else so that they can feel secure. And honestly, I'm of two minds of that. Part of me is like, well, great, that means we're all vulnerable and it's horrible and the world is going to end. And the other part of me is like, there's a certain amount of freedom in recognizing that you just can't stop this. It's sort of comforting to think that nobody is capable of protecting themselves, because it's actually a little more frightening to think that somebody has a monopoly on security, a dominance on security that allows them to do whatever it is they want at the expense of everybody else. So I don't want to say I'm happy about this, but it makes me a little comfortable to think that nobody's immune.
Well, Sarah, now I tell you, one of the things
that is a really sunny way to look at this, Dave.
It really is. He sounds kind of like the happiest guy at a public hanging. But,
it's not about the public hanging. Look at it this way: if this were a public hanging and only one person had rope, that's really frightening, right? There's something about us all having rope that's just a little bit, it just feels a little bit better.
Dave, you are a talented writer, and I'm not sure I am even slightly encouraged or comforted by the analogy you just used. But to me, the interesting thing about this and about, Sarah, what you said is that there are parts of this that the people who have been talking about advanced persist threats, the APT doomsayers of the world, have been talking about for years. And that is basically that every perimeter has to be seen as porous. And just the notion of an impregnable fortress around your network is an outdated concept. And so the issue is making the data that's inside the perimeter unusable if it's reached, and recognizing as quickly as possible that a breach has occurred so that you can do mitigation. I see a lot of wisdom to that approach from where you're sitting, looking at the security industry. Is that an approach that more people seem to be taking, or are we just, as an industry, too heavily invested in the perimeter to let go of the idea that if we just, you know, throw a bit more technology into the mix, we can get a grip on all this?
Now, there's definitely a maneuver to change that thinking. Now what we're seeing is everybody saying, assume you have been breached already or that you will be any day now. And the focus is now moving to following your data and finding where it might be ending up. So we're seeing more startups focusing on doing encryption that is a lot more, that really bolts itself onto the data a lot more closely. And And another product that just came out this week, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but I'll look it up before we're done, that's trying to, as soon as I guess it scans the black market for data. It basically puts a digital signature on whatever data that you might have in your enterprise, so that when it shows up places it's not supposed to be, you are made aware of the fact that it has shown up someplace. So even if you didn't necessarily detect the breach, you detected that the data was somewhere it wasn't supposed to be, and thereby figured out, oh, well, I guess there must have been a breach. So there's a lot more work being done on analytics, trying to note when something is amiss as soon as possible and do the mitigation as quickly as possible, because a big problem has been that it's taking weeks, months, years to find this stuff. And a lot of times it's not until the data is already being used for malicious purposes. A lot of times organizations are not finding out that they've been breached because they found it out themselves. They're finding out because somebody outside of the organization is reporting to them that something is amiss, that their account's been showing strange activity or something like that. So there's definitely a recognition in the industry that the whole perimeter defense thing is not working and hasn't worked for a really long time.
I love that approach, because it's kind of like finding your own stolen watch at a pawn shop.
You know, I've been trying to do that with something I lost years ago. Every once in a while I go out looking for this Cameo pin that I lost years ago, and I haven't found it yet, but I'm still hoping. That's a really good analogy.
It's a great plot for a movie. Sarah, there was a quote that I read, and unfortunately I don't remember who said it, but it was somebody inside the federal government who was a part of this, who mentioned that there was a security system the federal government uses that is supposed to track outgoing data, and they said that they were surprised by how many hours it took for this analytics security device to find out that all the data was leaving. Do you remember anything more about that you can say? Because that struck me as a really interesting quote that I read, and I'm sorry I don't have any more information on that.
Say it one more time, because you cut out for a second.
Somebody, a spokesperson for the federal government, said that they have a security system in place that's supposed to track outgoing data, and I forget the name. It had a cute name, like PRISM, but it wasn't PRISM. It was something like that. And it's supposed to track outgoing data, and it took many more hours to discover the breach than they expected it to, and that was one of the places they were looking.
I didn't see that, but I'll see what I can dig up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It makes bad radio when I can't give you more detail than that. I'm sorry.
Well, while I'm doing that, I can also point out the name of the product that I was just mentioning, that one that finds things on the dark market. It's called Terbium Labs. That just came out this week, and the one that really bonds the encryption more to the data that I was mentioning earlier, that's called Ionic. That's a really, really interesting company. So if you're interested in spending a lot on security, if you but you have serious data security needs, you should look them up too. All on this kind of stuff that we're talking about. And I don't usually pitch. I mean, but these are interesting companies doing fascinating work, and they're not sponsoring anything on dark reading yet, but but they're intriguing technology.
No question that this is a huge topic, and no doubt that we haven't heard the last of it. I suspect this is going to be one of those things, kind of like the Sony breach and the Target breach. For those of us who are journalists, it's just the gift that keeps on giving. And so I don't want to completely wear out our welcome with this topic this week. And, you know, there are some other things to talk about. It's not that this is the only news out there. For example, we got some more information on the breakup of HP. You know, they're going to be splitting the enterprise products from the consumer products, each becoming its own company with its own shares and that kind of stuff. And this week, the CEO of HP admitted that there was going to be some pain for employees involved in that, which is, as we all know, euphemism for the headcount of the two companies will at least at first be less than the headcount of the single larger company.
Wow.
Now, Dave, I want to turn to you first and ask first, does news like that surprise you? And second, do you think it's going to have any impact on what HP is, either side of it, is able to do in the market?
Right. Well, nothing surprises me when it comes to layoffs anymore. I think the solution that the stock market demands these days from any company is headcount. So, no, sadly. But I do have to say, usually, we see the opposite is so. Like, usually when a company merges, it lays off some people because there are redundant positions, especially in HR, marketing, sales, places where when two companies become one, you had two people doing the same job, and now you only need one person doing it, or one and a half people doing it, right? So the fact that the company's splitting and laying off is a little odd, because you've got to figure the two groups, whether it's HR, sales, marketing, IT, whatever, they have to have people now in both companies to do certain things. To run a network, to hire people, to whatever, right? So you have to wonder how they're going to do the job of two separate companies while laying people off at the same time. What I think this is actually an admission that HP was probably already bloated still to begin with, or else they couldn't lay off if they split. It's an illogical kind of thing. I think the truth is they're admitting that not only is it going to be pain in people, but it's going to be pain in sales. Revenue is going to go down for a while they do this. And I think that's not a surprise. I think HP has had trouble for years, and this is a response to that.
Now, Sarah, I heard you exclaim when I was going through my intro to this, does this news surprise you? And do you think it's going to have an impact on HP? And you know, maybe a little more personally, does it affect the way you think about HP?
Well, I agree with Dave that nothing in when it comes to corporate layoffs surprises me anymore. It just makes me sad when I hear about that much hemorrhaging. But what I think is peculiar about it is that because I'm still kind of fresh to the topic. So they're splitting. They're kind of separating the enterprise and the consumer side. Is that what I understand?
That's right. Basically, you get the things like laptops, desktops, scanners, printers, all of that stuff goes off onto the consumer company, while the servers, the networking stuff, and you know, it's kind of the back end data center stuff goes into an enterprise company.
Well, see, this is interesting to me because of the fact that we are seeing so much consumerization in the enterprise that they would, instead of kind of recognizing that fact, that there are more kind of consumer devices in the enterprise, and that they would go the opposite way and make these things more separate as opposed to more integrated. That surprises me just from a business strategy standpoint. And I'm not entirely certain what it is that they're – I don't entirely understand what it is they're trying to accomplish there.
I think what they're actually doing, though they'll never say this, is I think this is a way to exit the consumer business in a way
to
block of their enterprise business. I think
I think
they're doing what
I think other companies are also trying to do that.
I'm sorry?
I think other companies are trying to do similar things.
Yeah. This is what IBM
did,
except IBM was able to sell to Lenovo, and HP doesn't have anybody to sell its floundering consumer business to, I think is what's actually happening. But that's just a guess.
But now this begs the question, how many companies are left in the consumer market other than, it seems like Apple has just intimidated a lot of other companies out of the consumer laptop market anyway. Because I see, you know, there's Dell that's kind of sneaking away from it, and now HP is kind of sneaking away from it. It just seems like, I don't know, in the not-too-distant future, we're all going to have to buy Mac laptops, or we're not going to have any other options.
I think the truth is that the laptop is seen as something that's close to being done.
The Surface and the iPad.
Well, I just think that's what's happening. I think we're seeing the death. We're seeing the death of the non-mobile form factor. I think we're going to see something like a docking station, something that will allow a big monitor to be used with a small device. That's going to be what survives this, is the monitor and not the laptop itself. I think that's where we're headed. I think we're heading to the point where we're going to start carrying our computer around with us in our pocket, and then we're just going to be hooking it up to whatever thing it is that we want to work on, whether
it's our
tablet or our desktop
or what. Which is fine if I have a docking station that I'm plugging into at my house. But when I always think about this, I think about when I'm at a conference, and it's nice to have, you know, a tablet, which I don't have. It would be nice to have a tablet at a conference until I have to sit down and file copy in the press room. I don't want to be – if there's a docking station for me to hook up in there at the press room, fine. But at a smaller conference, they don't have those kinds of things. And I don't want to be sitting there trying to file a story on my tablet unless I have all kinds of other gear that's exciting that the company doesn't want to pay for, frankly. And until enterprises want to invest a whole lot more money in the kinds of sexy client technology, we're still going to be trucking out. I don't know. I'm against this, and I'm starting to get incensed, so I'm going to shut up.
Well, I think when you get incensed is when you should start. But I think that
I'm going to monopolize the rest of the conversation.
It's
not going to make any sense. It's just going to be Sarah venting her frustrations about something she's not even all that educated on anymore.
I think it's just going to become a niche. So it's right for certain companies to exit it while there will be somebody who picks up the slack.
I feel like I'm going to start learning shorthand, and I'm just not going to use computers anymore.
Now, see, I'm old enough. I remember shorthand being taught in high school, and I also remembering deciding not to take that class. Little did I know that someday I would probably want
it. I just started learning it, like, last week. I decided I needed to learn it, and I'm making the effort. It's not going well. But
well, I think I speak for everyone listening to Information Week Live in that we want to see a video as you progress. We want to see video about your progress with shorthand. You could lead a new revolution of shorthand dictation within the IT industry. And for those here live, remember, you heard it here first.
It'll be riveting stuff. I'll see what I can do.
Well, before...
Mostly in curses and confusion. That's probably what it'll look like.
Well, but before Sarah flies off in a state of high dudgeon about this, I think we should probably turn our attention to the story we always look forward to every week, and that is this week's Geekend. Now, Dave, I was doing a little bit of reading over at informationweek.com and was surprised to find myself looking through a windshield at this week's Geekend. What's going on?
Yeah, I found what I think is a surprisingly simple, really smart use of a technology that has kind of stopped being cool, and that is RFID tags. The country of Bolivia, which is not a country that we talk about too much as leading in technology, has come up with a pretty darn clever way of limiting illegal cars on their road. And what they're doing is they're simply requiring at registration of car, as a car is registered, like any other car is registered in the country, that they put a sticker on their windshield with an RFID tag in it. And then they have put readers at every gas station in Bolivia, or they will soon. They were at a pilot program now. They're expanding it nationwide this year. And as the car pulls into the gas station, the reader identifies whether the car has a tag on it. If it doesn't have a tag on it, the police are called. If it does have a tag, it checks to make sure that that tag matches the registration of the car with the license plate and the other information that is a part of the tag and a part of the car. And if it doesn't match, the police are called then as well. And in the pilot program, they identified 12,000 cars which were riding with duplicate license plates. So not even cars that were unregistered or cars that were stolen, but people who were using illegal license plates. They found 12,000 people in a pilot program already, and they're expanding this nationwide. What's interesting is there are only about 750,000 cars in Bolivia. So catching 12,000 with a pilot program is pretty impressive. Now imagine if you took that and expanded it to the 254 million cars there are in the United States, or the literally billions of cars in the world. So this seems like, to me, a really smart, really cheap, really affordable way to combat the kind of crime that cost government a lot of money to enforce without really adding too much in the way of resources.
Well, now, when I hear something like this, I have to admit, number one, I do think it's an awfully nifty application of technology. But I also know that when I go through the toll plazas using the little RFID dongle that I suction cup to my windshield, at least once a trip, it will fail to read going through the toll plaza. Now, my license plate is on record with the tollway authority here in Florida, so they're able to look it up and deduct it from my account. But still, we've got that level of non-reading. And yet this is something that we're supposed to apply to an even larger universe. And I haven't even gotten to the whole Big Brother, the government knowing where I am at all times aspect of this.
Right.
Is it reliable enough to really work for every car on a large nation's road?
Well, to be honest, I think there's going to need to be some working out, but the difference is in your toll booth scenario, you could be going by at 55 miles an hour. You have one shot for it to be red. In the gas station scenario, you're parked, you have, you know, a couple of minutes to read that tag. I think that changes significantly the reliability factor. Another thing you've got going for you is the technology has really improved a lot. Those tags that you're using for your toll aren't the latest technology in this. They are the ones that were adopted, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, depending on when, you know, which of those companies you're going through. So I do think we're going to see some problems to work out. I'm not naive. I've never met a technology that doesn't have these problems. But I think this is doable. I think the key here is you have to find a dependency, right? Every car needs gas, right? Well, almost every car. We're getting to the point. Tesla's going to change that. But every car needs gas. But you don't even have to put it at gas stations. You could put it in a mall parking lot. You could put it a lot of places. You could even attach it to those toll things if you want. There are a lot of ways to do it, but you just have to make sure you deploy it in a way that it's readable in a reliable way, and it casts a fairly wide net.
Well, now, we've been joined, I believe, by our colleague Charlie Babcock. Charlie, are you on the line?
Yes, Kurt, I am. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the conversation here. I hope that you've been able to hear what we've been talking about, this notion of embedding RFID tags in the windshields of cars so that we can keep track of who's driving into a city or across a bridge, kind of the same thing we do with the little road toll dongles that we suction cup to our windshields now. Charlie, I know that you spend a lot.
We call them fast track.
Fast, okay.
We call them fast track out here.
Here in Florida, it's fast pass, so same kind of deal. And I've got to ask, Charlie, you spend an awful lot of time looking at the back end of systems, the plumbing of our big applications. When you hear something about a system that might try to keep track of automobile movements around a country, do we have currently back ends that would allow us to do that with any kind of reasonable precision and performance?
Well, Kurt, I don't know of one existing, but it would be relatively simple to do that if the citizens would allow it. I have a sneaking suspicion that many people would resent the government noting each time they entered a city limit or crossed the bridge or something like that, and don't really want to be monitored that way. Getting the system to do it, even in real time, would be really quite simple.
You'd have
that tag as a unique identifier, and that's all you need, along with some kind of real-time reporting, which we have these days.
Now, Dave, I'm curious. You're usually, as I said earlier in the show, our privacy hawk out here. Can you imagine any arguments against this? I mean, on the one hand, I can. On the other hand, I know that there are states like Oregon who are looking at something similar to this for electric cars to try and figure out a rate of taxation to make up for all the money they don't spend on gas. So, you know, from where you sit, is this the kind of thing where citizens' objections are ultimately not going to weigh in the final decision?
Well, here's the key to this. In the case of what Bolivia is doing, Bolivia is not trying to track your location. They're simply trying to track whether you've paid for your registration. If you were, as a government, trustworthy, and it always comes down to this, right? Do you trust your government? If you wanted to put up a system that merely tracked it in locations like gas stations, or something that doesn't always track your location 100% of the time, I think people would be willing to say, look, they're just trying to enforce my my registration, just like when they pull me over for it, just like when they give me a ticket for not wearing my seatbelt, et cetera. People hate being caught by the government breaking the rules. They always do. But ultimately, we whine about getting caught speeding, but we don't really do anything about it because we know we're breaking a law that should exist. So the key is in implementation, right? What no one would support is tracking RFID tags at every intersection, at every stopping point, everywhere, so we always know where you are. No one would support that, and no one should support that. But there's a vast difference between what Bolivia is trying to do and what we're talking about there. Now, of course, the problem with any government is you give them an inch, they take a mile. The job of every government is on one level or another to increase its power, and that's the problem with all of these things. And so you're just going to have to decide as a society what kind of technology you're willing to let your state employ and what they're going to get away with when you do. I mean, compared to what the NSA is doing, I really don't have a problem with somebody checking whether I paid my registration. You know,
be comparing the data in real time against an existing database anyway. It's not like, it doesn't sound like they would be really collecting any new data.
Should return a yes, no answer. Did this person pay the registration? Does this car match? But the problem you have with that is we know that people have been convicted and also exonerated from crimes because of their RFID tags. They can show when they went across a toll.
That's true. Their BART cards,
their subway cards. So we've seen people say, you know, I wasn't there, and then we can prove through those things. So every time you add a stop on the grid, every time you say, we can show you got gas at X hour, you're adding another chance the government can use something against you. So I totally get this. We're at this point, though, where we're really fighting, we're fighting a more basic battle with our government, which is that our government has the ability to do a lot of these things whether we give them the chance to or not. So what we really need to do is start electing people who respect that as a concept.
It is an interesting concept. And I've got to admit, this is one of those things where I tend to fall into the leave me alone camp more times than not. But that's just me. I recognize that there are a lot of people who feel that in order to be secure, we need to allow more of this. And in some ways, what I'm hearing when I listen to you talking about having the information and being able to use it in one place and not use it in another and pass it to some agencies but not pass it to another are echoes of many of the debates that happened in the weeks and months post 9/11. When the argument was made that if only we had shared and combined and analyzed the data which existed, we might have been able to prevent it.
Go ahead, Sarah. Coming up again, not just in relation to the Patriot Act, but this has been coming up a lot in the security world lately with all of this discussion about encryption, because there's been this pushback from several governments, but particularly the U.S. government. They want to have, they've been talking about trying to weaken encryption algorithms or put in a backdoor that's just for government use, but of course they'd only use it when they really needed it, and they wouldn't share it with anybody else. Just for those occasions when they really need a piece of evidence and they can't get it because it's been encrypted, and whoever encrypted it will not give up the key. And even if they properly subpoena that key legally, if somebody isn't going to give it to them, they can't necessarily get that piece of data. And there's been a lot of law enforcement's been really, really pushing hard for it. And to my surprise, actually, they have not gotten any support from lawmakers on the issue. There's really the members of Congress have basically been telling them, tough luck. We don't really trust you to have this power. And it doesn't look like there's going to be really any efforts to give the intelligence agencies or law enforcement any kind of backdoors into encryption algorithms. And the United Nations just had a report that came out, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, saying that encryption and anonymity controls are essential to protecting human rights. So it's coming up a lot.
Yeah, and
indeed.
If we actually swung the pendulum in society to say privacy matters and freedom matters more than security, I would be the absolute first to cheer. I was against nearly every aspect of the Patriot Act when it was signed. I feel like we're never going to create a secure world, so violating freedom to create a secure world doesn't really make a lot of logical sense. So I'm really happy the pendulum is swinging back the other way. I just question whether even if society changes, whether government will, which is a real problem.
Now, Charlie, you're showing a diplomatic quiet so far in this discussion. And on the one hand, I admire that. On the other hand, I'm not going to let you keep it up. So where do you come down on all this? Is it a big deal, or is this the kind of thing that a lot of people in our industry like to talk about, but there's really not a whole lot of substance to the discussion?
Oh, it's really the commanding issue of our age. There's a lot of people that want to hang Snowden because of his revelations. And I don't think of him as the kind of shining light that we wish our children to grow up and be like. But on the other hand, I want to know what my government is doing to me. And Robert Snowden is one of the few people that's shown me that. So I have very mixed feelings on all these issues, which lends itself to keeping quiet sometimes. The logical construct, there's no point in trying to provide security by taking away freedom. That's a very good point. It's a very solid point. We must stand by that. But we live in a world where decisions have to be made very quickly, and information to make them is not often sufficient or available. I think of Mr. Putin and all of the levers of control he exercises over his own people. I don't want to see that in other places. And I think the more information you can track on people, the more location information, the more identity information that's in the hands of the government, the more we decrease the latitude of movement that citizens have. But the government can no longer guarantee us the kind of that another 9/11 event won't happen. And every government that gets to power is going to try to guarantee that. And the tension isn't that they want to be bad once they're in power. The tension is that they'll be held responsible once they're the ones in power. And when things go awry, none of the freedom advocates will stand up and say, well, you know, they had to do all that stuff to try to protect us. There's not an easy answer here. I don't know what the answer is.
Well, Charlie, right. you are bringing a voice of reasoned reflection and calm to the discussion, and that means we're going to ask you to come back and be with us much more often. It's not that that's completely absent in our discussion, but it's lovely to have your voice in the conversation here, as it is for everyone. Unfortunately, it's a conversation that is now coming towards its end as we reach the closing time for this episode of Information Week Live. We've had a really great discussion going on as well online with our listeners weighing in with their thoughts on this issue. And we would love to have more of our listeners' voice in this very important conversation. So feel free to let us know what you think. And if you're listening to this in an archive on-demand copy, the comments are still open. Let us know what you think. We would love to have an idea of what your voice is in this whole discussion, because I am pretty darn confident that this is not the last time we'll be talking about this here on Information Week Live. Well, before we let everyone go, we want to find out what's coming up. And Charlie, as the newest voice in our conversation here, we'll come to you first. What kind of things should people be looking for from you in the coming week at Information Week?
Well, you have the Hadoop Summit coming up in San Jose. It'll be a big gathering of the Hadoop implementers, the Hortonworks, Cloudera, the Apache Hadoop project itself. And I expect there'll be good big data news coming out of that. And I'll try to deliver some of it myself.
Well, we are going to be looking forward to that. And in order to keep up with what you're doing, where can people find you on the social networks? Should they be following you on Twitter or LinkedIn? Where are you presenting your minute-by-minute thoughts out on the social networks?
Twitter is the best source, I think, and I follow quite a few people there. And LinkedIn, not so much other than for more static information.
And remind us of what your Twitter handle is.
That'd be at Babcock CW.
At Babcock CW. If you haven't already done it, go out and follow Charlie right this minute. Well, Sarah, while our listeners are busy multitasking, following Charlie, tell us what you've got coming up for the coming week over at Dark Reading.
Well, we'll definitely continue to follow this OPM breach. I'm sure there will be more coming from that. And I'll also be looking towards the IFSEC conference week after next and the London Tech Week. I'm going to be over there. So lots of stuff coming from IFSEC and Interop London, bunch of stuff happening over there. And you can follow me on Twitter as well. That's just at Sarah Peters, no H.
And we certainly will do that. Always great information, and thanks for being with us. Well, Dave, it's time for you. I know that the Geek End is not the only thing you write for Information Week. You are a valued and heavy contributor. What are you doing for the coming few days at Information Week?
Yeah, on Sunday I'm going to have a slightly humorous look at the OPM breach. Data I wish they'd have taken instead of the data they did, including I wish we had found Obama's real golf handicap. and I'm also going to start previewing the E3 conference. The E3 conference is coming up in a little less than 2 weeks, and it is always a big deal for gaming and consumer electronics, which are things our IT Life readers enjoy reading. And, of course, we'll always cover the career and management advice that you also take very seriously at IT Life. But E3 is probably going to be my main focus next.
Well, we will look forward to all that E3 coverage, the previews, and the information coming out of E3. While you're doing that, I know that we want to keep up with exactly when you post those. So how do we follow you through the maze of the Tweety Pipes?
at Geekend Dave, which is like Weekend Dave except with a G.
Outstanding. Well, we will certainly look forward to adding you to our followed list. And as for me, I'm going to be coming up. I've got some articles in the works on things like Raspberry Pi projects that will help you learn IoT concepts. I've got a look at a Sennheiser headset that could be a valuable tool for mobile IT pros, and well, just a bunch of other stuff. And to figure out what I'm doing on any given day, be sure to follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Well, for Dave, Sarah, Charlie, and everyone here at Information Week, thank you so much for being with us. If you're listening to this on an on-demand version, then we're grateful. We're glad to have you as one of our listeners. But, you know, we would love to have your voice in the online discussion that happens around the live broadcast of Information Week Live. That happens at 3 p.m. Eastern Time every Friday. Look for the link on the front page of InformationWeek.com. And until next week, we will look forward to seeing you in the discussion around the articles at Information Week, and we'll be sure to see you next time.